From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump faces a 5 p.m. deadline today to decide whether he'll have his lawyers participate in remaining impeachment inquiry proceedings, including Monday's presentation of evidence against him by the House Judiciary Committee.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now, Sahil Kapoor, who's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Hi, Sahil.
Great to join you.
And Beth Fooey is senior politics editor for NBC News and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hey there.
And Beth, how do you expect Monday to play out as the House Judiciary Committee holds this hearing of the presentation of evidence?
Well, we're still waiting to see the list of witnesses that are going to step forward to the committee. But, you know, basically, we know what the evidence is. Adam Schiff released a lengthy report several days ago that outlined everything that they had come up with through their investigation, through all those many hearings that so many people watched at home from various civil servants and others who stepped forward to explain what they knew about President Trump's overtures to Ukraine around this, you know, investigation he wanted to do of the 2016 election and of the Bidens. And of course, the committee also collected a lot of other evidence separate and apart from the hearings about phone records and such. So we expect that that's what's going to be presented. We will see how or whether President Trump's team decides to participate in this, as you said. They declined to participate in that hearing on Wednesday, where several constitutional law professors came forward, but they did leave the door open to potentially participating in other hearings.
Well, reporters asked President Trump about impeachment yesterday. Here it is.
Are you worried, sir, about the stain that impeachment might have on your legacy?
No, not at all. No, not at all. It's a hoax. It's a hoax. It's a big, fat hoax.
Sahil, what's your sense of how President Trump is taking this? Democrats are looking at it as an historic moment. Is he taking it seriously?
The president is waging an aggressive campaign to undermine public support for impeachment, and it's not quite clear that is working. Shortly after Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a few months ago the impeachment inquiry, polls moved pretty quickly in the direction of supporting an impeachment inquiry, and there's somewhere around 50% of the country now supports impeachment and or removal, and a little under that, probably in the low, usually in the low 40s, opposes it. But the country remains very, very divided. And one of the big questions facing Democrats that they're going to consider next week is what the articles of impeachment should say. Are they going to focus on bribery and extortion charges as it pertains to the president's actions in Ukraine? That's the one issue that unites House Democrats, or at least a majority of the House, in pursuing impeachment, or are they going to look at other issues like potential obstruction of Congress, obstruction of justice, and as some progressives want to do, a possible violation of the Emoluments Clause?
And Beth, that question is particularly relevant for moderate Democrats who are representing swing districts where President Trump is still pretty popular. How are they taking this?
Well, there's a lot of reporting that shows that Nancy Pelosi is very much in touch with those freshmen, the 40 or so freshmen who bounced Republicans out of their seats in 2018 and are potentially the most vulnerable facing reelection in 2020. And so far, you know, as we've seen, her main goal is protecting her House majority, and yet she is pushing forward with this investigation. She's certainly doing it on constitutional principle, as she says, but it's unlikely that she would press forward this hard without feeling fairly confident that her freshmen and her other members in moderate or swing districts are going to be okay, and that there's not going to be this massive backlash. That said, and I agree with Sahil, it really remains to be seen what the articles of impeachment look like and how broad they go, because there certainly will potentially be a bigger threat for some of these moderate Democrats if the impeachment proceedings just sort of are like a massive throw the kitchen sink at President Trump. If it's a little bit more surgical, perhaps that would be a little bit easier for them to sell in their districts.
Sure. And speaking of Nancy Pelosi, there was this kind of remarkable moment yesterday when she was at a press conference and a reporter asked her if she hated President Trump. She turned back to the podium. She was walking away. And then she said this.
And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
Sahil, what did that tell you? Because I think this is starting to get a little tense, isn't it?
Quite a remarkable moment. I will say I've covered Speaker Pelosi in some form or fashion and over the last decade in Washington, and I've never seen her that worked up.
Really?
That comment clearly hit a nerve. And I think she was pushing back on this idea that it's personal, that she's pursuing something as grave and important and monumental as impeachment out of some kind of, you know, personal vendetta against the president. And she aggressively, as you just played there, pushed back on that.
There was another moment that was pretty tense, which was involving Joe Biden, one of the Democrats running for president, got a little angry at a voter at a town hall event in Iowa and called him a damn liar for saying that Biden and his son Hunter are as corrupt in Ukraine as President Trump. Here's Biden.
You said I set up my son to work in an oil company. Isn't that what you said? Get your words straight, Jack.
Beth, first of all, what do you make of that? And secondly, isn't he going to have to find a way to answer that question, which I'm sure is going to come up again if he's holding town halls without getting so angry about it?
Sure. I mean, it's never that great of an idea for an elected official or a politician seeking votes to yell at a voter or an attendee at their town hall. But, you know, one could take that a couple of different ways. One is that he was showing passion for his son and for his own integrity and credibility, which is what he's, you know, most trying to sell on the campaign trail.
Well, and people wanted him to fight back against this.
Right, right. And so there's certainly going to be a contingent of people who say, you know, right on, Joe, you know, good for you for, you know, showing some spine. On the other hand, he's sort of trying to sell himself as this, you know, stable guy. And you know, Republicans were, you know, quick to jump in on social media and, you know, frame him as, you know, unhinged and so forth. But look, I think the broader question is right. You know, how is he going to deal with this issue of the Republicans wanting to probe him and his son going into this impeachment? It's not something that he can just run away from. Republicans on the Senate are talking about calling Vice President Biden and his son as witnesses in the trial. It's just he cannot compartmentalize and pretend that that is not something that's happening and that that is not going to be something that is being discussed while he steps into the 2020 race toward Iowa, New Hampshire as the front runner.
Sahil, Pete Buttigieg is getting more scrutiny as he surges in the polls. Elizabeth Warren wants to know who his financial bundlers are. Joe Biden is accusing him of stealing Biden's health care plan. Questions are being raised about his work for McKinsey, where he signed a non-disclosure agreement. And yesterday he gave an interview on NBC News about his struggle to win over a diverse group of voters and about his level of experience.
Well, look, every passing year in your life, you gain experience. And I believe that you need to continue learning each moment that you're alive. But I would also stack up my kind of experience from military service to executive leadership to what I've been able to do around the country and around the world among any of my competitors is something that prepares me for the presidency.
Sahil, what's your sense of how he's handling the pressure of rising in the polls?
Pete Buttigieg is certainly rising to the top tier of the Democratic race, and he's starting to get the kind of scrutiny that top-tier candidates get. The New York Times editorial board had a piece yesterday that was published online yesterday pressuring Pete Buttigieg to disclose who his clients were during his work at McKinsey and to talk about the kind of work he did after some reports about, you know, it came out about McKinsey partnering with ICE, advising them on the logistics of an immigration crackdown. And the Times noted that this was about 20% of Buttigieg's entire post-college career. He is only 37 years old. So he seems to be handling this in the way we know him to be. He's an even-keeled person. He doesn't get too high, too low. He doesn't easily get rattled. And to your point about his struggles with non-white voters, this is a very real obstacle. And this is probably his single biggest hurdle to climb. He is only at 2% in the latest poll of The Economist and YouGov with black voters. And that's a crucial constituency that he has to do better with if he's going to stay a top tier contender after the first two states.
And Beth, does Buttigieg have something of an advantage going into January when you have what? Is it like five senators who are in this race who will be tied up for a long time right at the moment when the Iowa caucuses, they would be barnstorming through Iowa in order to prepare for that caucus in February. They'll be distracted in Washington with this Senate trial.
Right. That could take Senator Warren off the campaign trail, Senator Sanders, Amy Klobuchar. No question that leaves the non-senators a little bit advantaged. But to Sahil's point, I mean, even if Buttigieg has, you know, a full free rein in Iowa to sort of build on the strength that we've seen him gaining in that first state, if he doesn't do better with black voters, it's game over. It's just impossible for a Democrat to win the nomination without the support of black voters, especially black women. And certainly Mayor Buttigieg is doing a lot of work to shore up his situation with black voters, but it doesn't seem to be bearing a lot of fruit at the moment. So even if he, you know, has got Iowa, you know, more or less to himself, maybe just competing with Joe Biden in January there, he's really got to do better with black voters, which is, of course, a big source of Joe Biden's strength and why he's in the lead in most of the polling that we've seen.
That is Beth Bowie, senior politics editor for NBC News and MSNBC, and Sahil Kapoor, who is national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks for having me.
Gentrification has touched almost every major American city, from New York and San Francisco to Detroit and Sacramento. And in many cases, it's been accompanied by displacement. Longtime residents, especially residents of color, pushed out as prices rise. As cities look for solutions, author Matthew Sherman points to the decades-long history of gentrification and the lessons that come with it. Matthew is a senior editor at WNYC in New York and author of Newcomers, Gentrification and Its Discontents. He joins us now. Hi, Matthew.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you start in this book by saying that gentrification isn't necessarily a bad thing.
That's right. It's really just a process by which a neighborhood goes from being, say, a little less than the median income for the area to above. It's sort of a, you got to think of it as a neutral phenomenon, like gravity or wind or rain. You know, they can get you really wet and be really damaging, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you figure out how to harness those elements, then you can actually maybe turn into something to your benefit.
Well, and if you said the word gentrification to one person, they might have a positive thought about it, and another person might think it's the worst thing in the world.
Yes. I have to say, when I started reporting, people in New York seemed to think gentrification was just fine. It was just sort of a normal thing. People would even joke about how they were part of it. And then I started reporting out in San Francisco, and it was just a bad word. I could not use that word when I was telling people what I was reporting on.
When did gentrification as we know it begin?
I think it started in the 1950s. That's where I start my book. You could argue it started even earlier in the 1930s, Georgetown, 1910s, Greenwich Village in New York. But I picked late 1950s, because that's when this group of people in Brooklyn Heights really were self-conscious about wanting to live in the city, not go to the suburbs like so many of their white counterparts were doing. And they were also against urban renewal. That is sort of the wholesale demolition of slums and replacement with large concrete boxy buildings.
They saw themselves as pioneers who were civilizing the urban frontier.
Yes. And I don't think they realized at the time how racist that might sound to people. But I think looking back on it, we really question that sort of language and that attitude, as if these neighborhoods were not good neighborhoods or functional neighborhoods beforehand.
But a lot of these people were focused on preservation, on historic preservation, restoring some of these beautiful old buildings that had been in disrepair.
That's right. They wanted to restore the buildings. They thought differently sometimes about the neighborhoods, although some of them really, you know, appreciated the diversity, the vibrancy that they found in these city neighborhoods as well. It almost became a problem, though, too much of a good thing, as the gentrifiers moved into these neighborhoods, sort of overwhelmed them, and then many, many years later have started to push people out.
And how much did the city leaders get involved when this was happening? Did they look at it and say, okay, we need to set the rules of how gentrification is going to happen? Or did they say, well, you know, well, let's just see what happens with this?
Pretty much they were pretty hands-off about it. And that's what's interesting, is that it's more a question of what they didn't do as opposed to what they did. Mm. A lot of the problems with urban renewal, for example, or where people placed public housing in this country have to do with things that public policymakers, government leaders did. But it was more that some mayors saw this coming, economic development officials, and they thought, this is fantastic. It doesn't take any public money at all. People are reviving the city on their own.
What did gentrification look like in Chicago compared to New York? Because you spent some time on Chicago. I actually lived right next to Cabrini Green, which was this old housing project that you talk about. But now it's, you know, two blocks away from a Crate and Barrel. So it's changed very rapidly. How did it differ from what happened in New York?
That example, I should say that there are plenty of other examples in Chicago where gentrification did happen in sort of the more traditional way, where you have an old neighborhood like Old Town or Lincoln Park, Wicker Park, et cetera. People move in, privately renovated. But I wanted to look at what happens when you take an entire public housing complex and you try to, in essence, gentrify it. They didn't use that name. They didn't see it as gentrifying it. They wanted to break up that concentrated poverty. They were trying to solve a problem and undo all the mistakes of the past. But they sort of used the spirit of gentrification and the dynamic of it, basically by moving a lot of low-income people out of there to other places, and then inviting middle and upper middle income people in. And the most amazing thing is just that these class lines persisted even when people were intentionally integrated with one another. They built these buildings so that there would be no difference in the apartments, where they were placed. They all looked the same, whether they're subsidized for low income people or whether they were market rate. And nonetheless, these class differences really came out, and there has been a lot of tension and resentment since then.
Where do you think we are right now in the long history of gentrification? Is this the boom of it? There are so many neighborhoods in this country that are changing so rapidly, that are gentrifying so much right now. Is this more than we've seen in the past, or where are we?
Definitely more. There was a study by Governing Magazine that basically looked at gentrification, found that between 2000 and 2010, it was one out of every five low-income urban census tract had gentrified. So we'll wait, and next year after the census data comes out, we'll see. But it certainly seems like it's accelerating. I get gentrification alerts, Google alerts, from places like Auburn, South Carolina, Buffalo, New York, places that you would never think would gentrify are experiencing that now.
Are we getting any better at it?
We are getting more conscious of it. The biggest issue, though, is that so often it seems like every city discovers gentrification all over again. They pretend, or they act, or maybe they genuinely didn't see it coming, and they have to reinvent the wheel. When in fact, if you look back in the 1970s, when people became conscious of gentrification, a lot of those solutions that are being presented now were actually presented 40 years ago.
Let's talk about some solutions to gentrification. A lot of people argue that increasing the supply of housing would fix this process by bringing down prices. What did you learn about that?
I think that increasing the supply has got to be part of the solution. Absolutely. One problem is, though, that when new units are built, they always enter at the high end of the market, so that developers will build luxury units unless they're subsidized. So it takes a long time to have this filtering process where it will actually help people in the middle income or lower income strata. And that's not happening fast enough. So the experts that I've consulted recommend some sort of mixture between new market rate and new subsidized housing.
You spoke with a lot of people who were affected by gentrification personally. Is there somebody or a story that sticks in your mind?
Well, one of the people whose life I trace is Rene Yanez, and he was an artist in San Francisco, and he helped make the Mission District sort of what it is today in many ways. He started the mural movement. He co-founded an art gallery. He encouraged and fostered this sense of Chicano, Latino identity for the Mission. And, you know, lo and behold, when a neighborhood becomes attractive in that way, it also becomes the target of gentrification. We all want to live in nice, vibrant, diverse, different sorts of communities. So unfortunately, he was threatened with eviction. He fought mightily. The fact that he had such deep and extensive roots in the community no doubt helped. He got the media on his side. He got government officials on his side, and he was able to survive his final years in his same apartment.
What do you say to people who listen to this and say, well, wait a minute, gentrification, from my perspective, has made my area safer, has taken a place that may have been in disrepair and made it look beautiful. And I feel safer raising my children in this part of the city that I didn't before because of gentrification. What's wrong with that?
It's true. It goes back to the first question you asked me. Is gentrification good or bad? No, it's sort of a neutral sort of thing. It's a question of how do you tame it so that, let's say, you're not pushing people out, but you are able to get the infusion of cash and wealth that you need to improve a neighborhood. But that also raises the question, why is it that white people need to move into a neighborhood before a city starts paying attention to it? I mean, I know it's not literally that case, but that's what you – when you read the academic literature, you actually sort of see that academics are saying actually one of the benefits is that the people who stay, the low-income people who stay in these neighborhoods, they get better schools, they get better trash pickup, they get better police protection, and that's got to raise some questions too.
Race is really at the center of this.
It's a big part of it. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there is white on white gentrification, absolutely. But race has certainly exacerbated the tensions that we see around gentrification. And also, if you think about like the African American renter in a poor neighborhood in the 1960s or 70s, let's say this person has enough money to buy a house, but they can't buy an apartment or a house in their neighborhood because of redlining. Banks won't lend to them. Nor can they move outside of their neighborhood because there are real estate agents who won't show them homes there. Also discrimination. They end up continuing to rent. And now that we see gentrification affecting these low-income black neighborhoods, these are the people who are most vulnerable because they have not put down the roots. They've not owned their homes. And home ownership is one of the best ways to resist gentrification.
That is Matthew Sherman, whose new book is called Newcomers, Gentrification and Its Discontents. We know you'll have thoughts about this, so leave them at hereandnow.org. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Uber says that there were 3,045 reports of sexual assaults during rides in the United States in 2018. That is up from 2,936 reported in 2017. The company stresses that with 2.3 billion rides in the U.S. in those 2 years, sexual assault during an Uber ride is very rare. But it does show there are risks for Uber passengers and drivers. Joining us now is Johanna Buya, reporter at the L.A. Times. Hi, Johanna.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well, and we should say again that some of the cases are against the drivers, but the reported assaults include non-consensual touching, unwanted kissing, and rape. There are no national numbers for sexual assaults in taxis, so it is not easy to compare. But how big an issue is safety for Uber?
Safety has sort of always been an issue that has plagued Uber's platform. The company used to call itself the safest ride on the road, but actually was sued and had to stop calling itself that because there weren't enough safety protocol and features implemented in the app to call itself that. So the company has faced lawsuits since as far back as at least 2014, when there was the sort of notorious case of a woman being raped in India, causing the company to be banned in Delhi. So safety has been a real big issue for Uber for years. But under the new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, the company has only now just been rolling out comprehensive safety features in earnest.
Well, they've put in a panic button, which I guess helps the driver. But if it's the passenger who's in trouble, is there anything Uber can do to address those concerns about safety?
Sure. Yeah, I actually think that a lot of the features are more geared toward passengers at this point. The panic button is also available to riders. So there is a 911 button. They can also text their local police officer at this point. They're testing out audio recording of the rides, which will help riders and drivers. There's also an ability to send your ETA and your trip information to people that you might want to know where you are. So there's a number of features geared toward passengers now, and they're in the report, they've said that they're planning on rolling out additional features in the next few years.
Will being transparent about the number of sexual assaults reported help the company?
Absolutely. I think credit where credit is due. This is the first of its kind transparency report. Like you said, there really isn't even national information on this in the transportation industry. The numbers are jarring to look at because it's the first time that we are getting any kind of a look at what sexual assault complaints look like on any of these rideshare platforms. But I do think, particularly because sexual assault is, you know, studies have said that it's underreported across the country, this will at the very least act as an invitation to those who have been victims of sexual assault or misconduct on Uber's platform to come forward, knowing that there is sort of a forum for that.
Uber only released numbers of reported sexual assaults in the U.S. Do you have any idea how it might compare to other countries?
I don't. The company has not put out any numbers. I mean, you know, this is the first time we're even seeing what they look like at all in the U.S. In the past, when I worked at BuzzFeed News, reported that there were more than 6,000 sexual assault complaints on the platform over the course of 3 years in the U.S. And at that point, even the company sort of declined to reveal what those numbers actually look like, even though they've time and time again said that they have a robust data set and they're really aware of what's happening. So if this is sort of the first look that we're getting at all, and up until now, Uber and Lyft have both declined to reveal any information, it's really difficult to say what it looks like outside of the U.S. at this point.
That's Johanna Puglia, reporter with the L.A. Times. Johanna, thanks.
Thank you.
And it's been a week of confusion and fear in Port Neches, Texas, about 100 miles east of Houston. That's where an explosion at a chemical plant injured three workers and forced 60,000 people to evacuate the day before Thanksgiving. The fires were finally put out on Tuesday, but this week officials ordered another round of voluntary evacuations because of high levels of a carcinogenic chemical in the air. The evacuation order has since been lifted. Toxicologist Angie Perez told reporters yesterday that chemical levels are no longer dangerous, but may still cause problems.
You can get a headache just based on the odor itself, not based on any kind of toxicity response.
And that has not exactly calmed people's concerns. Jacob Dick is a business reporter for the Beaumont Enterprise. Jacob, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And this sounds like a terrible situation for people in that area. First of all, the explosions. Then this chemical lingering in the air after people had been told they could safely return home. Schools closed again this week and then opened and then closed again. What's the latest? Is it safe? Does anyone know?
So I've just been looking through the EPA air monitoring reports from yesterday, and it seems like a few hours before they lifted the mandatory evacuation, they had no elevated levels of butadiene. But as for what are the long-term health effects, that's something that I personally haven't had answered for me.
Okay. And that chemical that you just mentioned, butadiene, what is it? How dangerous is it?
Butadiene is a precursor for synthetic rubbers and some plastic materials, and it's been a known carcinogen for several decades by U.S. and global researchers. And mostly we know why it is a carcinogen because there's been human studies and human tests from people that have worked around this before modern air quality procedures that had cancer.
And the reason it was there in the first place is because this plant owned by TPC Group was using it to make chemicals that are used in tires and in gasoline. But do we know anything else about how that explosion happened in the first place?
So we heard a little bit yesterday from the Chemical Safety Board. They gave their first update since hitting the ground. And so we heard from some interviews of employees there that three of the people that were injured said that they saw some chemicals leak onto the ground that vaporized, and soon it caught fire and caused the explosion. They think that chemical might have been butadiene, but there has been no conclusive test.
You've called this area the chemical breadbasket of the U.S., and of course that comes with problems. The Houston Chronicle found that between 2014 and 2016, there was the equivalent of one industrial chemical accident every 6 weeks in greater Houston. Does this most recent plant explosion fit into what is really seems like a much bigger story?
Yeah, I think that we'll have to see exactly what the root cause was, and maybe learn a little bit more about how this particular company practices in terms of safety. But I will say, you know, critics of the industry and how they've handled public safety will say that the regulatory power of our state and federal agencies just don't force industries to be safer.
And maybe the reason is because the oversight appears at least to be lax. The Federal Chemical Safety Board is reportedly understaffed. It investigates a very small portion of these accidents, essentially leaving the industry to police itself.
Right. And the correlation between climate releases and not being in compliance with climate regulations is kind of shaky. But, I mean, this company was out of air compliance for at least a year. It's paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. And it makes you wonder exactly what they are doing.
Look, I know these plants are an important part to the local economy. People need the jobs that they provide. But, you know, from your reporting after this latest incident and, you know, some of the others in the region, are people thinking about getting out of the shadow of living in these plants?
Talking to people on the ground in their homes or at the Red Cross help centers, it's a mixed bag. People are worried, but this plant's been in their community since 1945. Most of them know it as the original Natchez butane plant. This is something they've grown up around. Probably several generations of their family have worked in similar plants. So I think we'll have to see how it changes public opinion here.
That's Jacob Dick. He's business reporter for the Beaumont Enterprise. Jacob, thanks for your time. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Texas also figures into our next story. It's about a college football game played 50 years ago today between the University of Texas Longhorns and the Arkansas Razorbacks. As Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports, the game was just part of the story.
Saturday, December 6th, 1969. Razorback Stadium, Fayetteville, Arkansas.
They called it the game of the century, but it was also a game of the times, America in 1969.
Race, religion. Religion's a big part of this. A divine intervention in politics, war. It's just life, and it's not totally undifferent than what we're living today.
That's Mike Looney, author of the new book, The Big Shootout, The Untold Story of the Game of the Century. He's also produced a documentary about the game. That story starts with the head of ABC Sports at the time, Rune Arledge. He wanted to celebrate the centennial of college football with a national championship game. President Richard Nixon would present the winning team with a trophy. Looney says Arledge asked another ABC guy, Beano Cook, to look at the season schedule and pick out a game that could be moved to the first Saturday in December for this special event.
No computers. He just pours over all those schedules, and he says, look, I think if we move Texas and Arkansas, they'll be 1-2. And Rune goes, that's impossible. Ohio State's the defending champ, and they've got all their starters back. And Beano said, I just think they'll lose.
That's exactly what happened.
What has to be the upset of the century.
With Michigan knocking off Ohio State, Texas jumped to number one, Arkansas to number two. ABC had its dream matchup. Again, this was 1969. There would be no black players in the big game. At Arkansas, Mike Looney says, African Americans protested. They didn't want Dixie played at the pregame pep rally. And Looney says the school's band director agreed.
And so at the pep rally that night, Doc Worthington, who was 90 when we interviewed him and still wore his band uniform, he decided not to play it, and he announced it at the pep rally.
So Dixie wasn't played at the pep rally or at the game.
An allied force of more than 8,000 men today tightened its hold on the Batangan Peninsula on South Vietnam's central coast, trapping an undetermined number of North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops in tunnel and bunker systems.
The Vietnam War was also raging and hitting home. The first draft lottery was held the week of the Texas-Arkansas game. The brother of one of the Texas players had been killed in the war just a few months before. Donald Donner was a Vietnam veteran going to school at Arkansas. Here he is speaking in the documentary.
So upon hearing that Nixon was going to be here, along with television cameras up there in the press box, I decided to do something about it.
That something was erecting a huge peace sign on a hillside outside the Razorback Stadium in Fayetteville. President Nixon saw it, but if you were watching on ABC TV, you didn't. What you did see on television that day was a football game for the ages.
Here's McClard's kick with the wind to his back. It's a good one.
Arkansas took a 14-0 lead into the fourth quarter, but Texas quarterback James Street broke off a long touchdown run and added the two-point conversion to make it 14-8.
Jimmy Street in trouble. Gets away. There he goes.
I'm 70. I was 20 watching the game on TV in Lubbock, and I'm going to tell you, no one can know what it felt like unless you were watching it. You didn't know about the racial stuff, and you didn't know about the politics. It was just that TV was about to explode.
In the final minutes, Texas drove to the Arkansas 2-yard line and scored the tying touchdown.
And now, Happy Feller, who has kicked 42 of 44 extra points. This is a big one. It's up. Yeah.
The extra point kick made it 15-14 Texas. And that's how the game ended. President Nixon spoke in the jubilant Texas locker room.
The fact that you won a tough one for a team to be behind 14 to nothing and then not to lose its cool and to go on to win, that proves you deserve to be number one, and that's what you are.
More than 30 years after this game of the century, players from both teams got together for a reunion you can see in Mike Looney's documentary.
It's amazing how close these kids, these men my age are now bonded by this experience that's deeper than you can ever imagine, the effect that this game had on these kids, these players' lives and coaches.
The years, he says, have blurred the line of scrimmage. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
In Miami, public transit activists are remembering a leading young voice to their cause who tragically took her own life last week. Alejandra Agredo was only 17. She was a student at Coral Gables Senior High School who often attended public meetings and had just formed a nonprofit to bring bus, train, and bicycle riders together to fight for more reliable transportation. A memorial service is planned for tomorrow. Kevin Amezaga co-founded the Miami Riders Alliance with Alejandra and is now acting president. He's also 17. Kevin, thank you for speaking with us about your friend and our condolences to you.
No, thank you.
Well, and tell us more about Alejandra's work to improve public transit in Miami.
So Alejandra was passionate, brilliant, and all around an amazing person. Because not only was she a transit advocate, she believed in making people's lives better through what she was good at. So, for example, she's an amazing coder. She had first started by creating Wayline, which is an application that agglomerates all the GPS data from public transportation systems in Miami-Dade County, because right now we have an application called MDT Watch, but it's not real time for every system, so it's not very useful. Mm-hmm. She never finished it completely. But it's still a fast improvement from what we have currently from the government.
And what was her goal?
Her goal was to help people. You know, in Miami, we're not a very mobile city unless you have a car. And she didn't believe in the automobile. She believed that it really is a barrier to people who aren't able to drive or who don't want to drive. So she really aimed to, you know, make people more mobile and make it so that if you don't have a car, it's not like you have your legs cut off, you know?
And the people who are officials in the transportation world in Miami-Dade County knew who she was pretty well, right?
Yes. She would just go to government meetings for fun, like for entertainment almost. But it was really to, you know, support the transit cause. She would go and speak her mind often. She would meet with elected officials, go to budget meetings. So she was very active in the local government.
And what made the two of you form the Miami Riders Alliance?
So Alejandra contacted me in late September to see if I wanted to be a part of something bigger than just tweeting on Twitter and, you know, talking to local officials as individuals. She wanted to create a network. So she wanted us to be under one organization so that our voices would be amplified.
So what does it mean that her voice is gone now in the fight for transit?
her voice being gone is honestly a devastation, not only for our organization, but for Miami-Dade transit advocacy as a whole. You know, we don't have many voices constantly and passionately fighting for transit in our county. So losing her is a loss. And even those opposed to her ideas came out and said that they'll miss her because they don't have people challenging them.
So I'm sure that it is still pretty shocking that she is no longer alive. And in fact, even the way that she took her life, stepping in front of a train, her father told the Miami Herald that she was adept at masking depression. Did you know she was depressed?
I did not. You know, as Generation Z, a lot of my peers will joke about things like suicide or, you know, taking their own life. We say it as a casual remark, not I'm seriously going to kill myself. And I think that that's a huge problem with the way that we use language nowadays. I did not ever for a moment suspect that Alejandra was capable of killing herself. I was helping her with scholarship applications only a week or two before. You know, she had a bright future. We had just incorporated. She went the day before, you know, dying to BB&T to open up a bank account for us. For Writers Alliance. So I'm still in shock.
So what would you say to other teenagers if they're worried about their friends?
I think that it's very important to check up on people, even if you're not that close anymore. Because, you know, a like on Instagram doesn't mean that you're still there for them. You know, you have to really be there for people. And it's something that with social media and moving away from physical interactions with people that we're really losing.
Well, Kevin, we're so sorry for your loss and hope that you're able to continue the work that you and Alejandra had been doing on public transportation in Miami.
Thank you.
That is Kevin Amezaga, who is the acting president of the nonprofit Miami Riders Alliance, helping us remember his friend and co-founder, Alejandra Agredo, who died by suicide last week at the age of 17. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Democrats will move ahead with drafting articles of impeachment against President Trump.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act.
We'll have the latest as impeachment hearings continue next time on Here and Now.